Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Sons of the Double Cheeseburger podcast. I'm Kevin Woosley with
Brandon Woosley.
There you go.
There I am.
This week, we're going to be talking about a book that we both read that we got from our mother for Christmas, right?
That's right.
And we will introduce that book when we get there. But first, we'll kind of check in and see how we're doing. Hi, Brennan.
How are you doing? Oh, I got you first. Now you have to say.
Dang.
Yeah.
I know. All right. I'm doing okay. Yeah, I got rid of a car yesterday.
Yeah.
And I sold it to a junkyard, which feels very woozly.
It's on brand. Yeah,
It is. But Victory Auto Wreckers is where I sent it. If you were from Chicago, you will recognize Victory Auto Wreckers.
That's right.
And they have really leaned into their kind of cult status.
Have they?
Yeah. They've got like stickers that say that old car is worth money, and it's got a picture of the old Chevy Caprice with the door falling off and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's and they're on like all of the social medias. I mean, they're not on Parler, I guess, but they're
who is right
on Parler or MeWe or what's some of the other ones?
Are they on Gab? They got a big presence at Gab.
No, they
maybe a Telegraph channel.
No, they seem to be in the resistance.
All right. So they're officially not the official car wrecker of the alt right.
Correct. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So, so I sold a car there and, today went and looked at a new car, but, I have some reluctance to spend the money on another used car. So
sure. Well, that's what I was going to say. When you said on a new car, I thought my first question was, you know, for the Woosley brand, you don't really mean a new car, right?
Right. New to me.
New to you. That's the Woosley way.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I mean, let's be honest. You buy a new car and it's so much depreciation right away.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's like recycling to buy a used car.
That's true. I mean, there are a lot of people that say that in terms of environmental care, unless you're buying something that's really, well, even if you're buying something that's electric or something like that, just in terms of what everything it takes to make a car, you might as well use another used car. Yeah. Honestly, for me though, the only reason I like my last car is a new car. And it's just because of the security of being pretty confident that for 100,000 miles or so, I'm not going to have to fix anything. Cause I don't know how to fix anything.
Yeah. Warranty is a big draw.
Yeah.
Clearly. Like we bought Eileen's current car, a minivan, new.
Yeah.
And we bought it with a lifetime warranty. We paid like a pittance for this lifetime warranty. And I think Chrysler has since stopped selling these.
Okay.
I think they've come to regret them. But I think we only added like $1,000 or $1,500 to the price of the car.
Wow.
And you know, we've gotten a new transmission. We've gotten we've clearly gotten our money's worth out of it. And
excellent.
It was probably less than even like $1,000 or $1,500. It was a really small sum of money. And so,
sure.
So we're just going to keep that car until forever. I don't know. I mean,
there you go. That's right.
Lifetime. You know, it's, I mean, and almost everything is covered. So, you know, I try and think of what is the point where they say, oh, that's not covered. Well, like the engine blows up, that's covered. You know, at some point, either they're just going to have to say, we're just going to stop honoring this contractual warranty we have, or they'll just have to keep fixing it.
Makes sense.
Like if it rusts away or something, then sure, they're not on the hook for that. But yeah.
Right. Right. By the way, if just, you know, I know that there's about $1.4 billion worth of lottery proceeds up for grabs this weekend. If you win, might I suggest that you buy David Hasselhoff's personal kit Knight Rider car, which is currently up for auction, and the bid is at $475,000?
I would consider that, yes. I feel bad that the Hoff is having to sell his Knight Rider vehicle, right?
Well, it sounds like he's selling a lot of this stuff. He says that it's going to charity, although then you look closer and it says a portion of it is going to charity. Well, so
even a portion is more than none.
I mean, a portion is more than none. It does suggest that maybe a portion of it is also going to the charity Actors Without Jobs. specifically actors named David Hasselhoff without jobs.
The Wanted Cheeseburger Fund, right?
But honestly, you know what? I mean, would you rather have like enough money to live on, or would you rather have the kit car?
No, I'd rather have enough money to live on, right?
Yeah, you'd look at it, you'd be like, this is an asset that I have. I'll turn this into living.
Yeah, yeah.
So, makes sense. Yeah, it's cool. Well, you know, congratulations on getting to do one of the great things, one of the rites of passage of Chicago culture.
Yeah, I mean, I think next for me is I'm going to try and go smelt fishing.
That's good. That's good.
Or
Can I recommend get yourself really drunk on Malort before you do it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't...
Get all malorted up and then go smelt fishing.
Smelt is one of those things that I think it's one of those types of fish that you just eat the whole thing, bones and everything.
I believe so.
And I'm like, not ready for that. Now, there is a place, I think it's Calumet Fisheries, or, you know, that on the far south side, mm-hmm. where you can buy smoked smelt. And maybe I'll try
it. Nice. There you go.
Yeah. Well, so how about you? What have you been up to?
Getting dental work done this week. That was exciting. Yeah.
How you feeling?
You know what? Honestly, like about 3 weeks ago, they cleaned one side and they didn't want to do both sides the same day because they had to do a lot of numbing. So we came back and did the other side. And this time, first of all, the numbing lasted a lot longer. Like, I could not use my lips or my tongue properly for about 3 hours afterwards.
Seems like a long time.
And my tongue felt like a beef tongue sitting in the bottom of my mouth. It just felt like this, like, it felt like it was pulling my head down. It felt so heavy. So then it finally, that all went away, but my jaw, not the teeth, but my jaw itself is sore and is still sore. This was like 2 days ago. So I'm a little irritated, but I don't know. Other than that, I mean, they didn't have any big problems. I am going to have to get wisdom teeth out. Did I already tell you this previously?
You did.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we should do that as a podcast, but I don't think they're going to allow us to do that.
So here's what we'll do. We'll do the getting drunk on Malort.
Yeah.
And then right away, you'll get the wisdom teeth out.
I like that. It's good. Because he says it's sideways and it's jamming into another tooth.
Oh, that's.
He's like, doesn't this hurt? I was like, no. He's like, it should hurt. I'm like, doesn't. So. Yeah, did that. Finished up the paperwork for Zachary's conservatorship today. So I'm going to submit that on Monday. That's a legal process in the state of California where once someone is legally an adult, if they need someone to help making key decisions and things like that, it's like guardianship in a lot of other states. Okay. So we're finishing that process because his 18th birthday is coming fast. And I don't want him to get married really quick after he turns 18. A little worried about that.
Sure.
I'm worried, honestly, that some girl is going to come along and she's going to marry him for my money.
That again, is a risk.
All that Woosley coin.
Right.
In fact, I'm looking at it right now. I have a jar that used to have coconut oil in it that has all the Woosley coin. I think it's about $17 right now in there. So yeah, and I was pretty proud of that because that's a big process completing all that paperwork, and we did it without a lawyer this time. So,
very good.
Yeah. So yeah, that's the main stuff we got going on.
Is that an emotional process?
Not really. I mean, it was. You know what? It actually was a little more so for me. We've done the same process for Joshua, and with Joshua, that's a little more of an emotional process for me because I think that, the reason we did that with Josh at this point is that we do think that Josh, for a couple of reasons, is at risk of being taken advantage of.
Okay.
But I also believe that ultimately Josh is going to be independent. He's going to live independently. He's going to, I don't think Josh is going to need this kind of support forever, but I do think for a little while he would benefit from that, and he felt that as well, and so he was cool with us doing this process. So that one is like more emotional because it feels like I'm going to do this, and then there's going to be a point where we're going to make the decision to rescind that. Mm-hmm. That conservatorship, so that he has full control over these various decisions and processes, and I feel like that's going to be emotional when that happens. For Zachary, this is just kind of an extension of, you know, what has always been. I think we know that Zach is always going to need somebody to help look out for him, and so it, you know, the fact that he's about to turn 18 is a little crazy, but.
That's very crazy, if you ask me.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't approve this, rapid aging of my children. It turns out they didn't rapidly age. They aged at the normal pace. Which means I have continued slowly aging. So,
you know, if Zach was on Jupiter, though, he'd only be turning one.
And I just read something else that, I think it's on Venus, a day is longer than a year. Did you know that?
Really?
Yes. So I won't get the numbers exactly right, but Venus takes something like 225 days to go around the sun. So that is 1 year. Okay. Mm-hmm. But it rotates very, very slowly. And so for the planet to do a full rotation is like 245 days. So a full rotation of the planet is 1 day.
So a day in a year. Well, so a year based upon the idea of, you know, our Terran idea of what a year. What
yeah, I don't know. I don't know how the Venetians. Monitor. Do they call themselves Venetians?
That's what I would have thought was the nomenclature. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's get some Venetians on our podcast and we can.
We don't have any Venetian listeners, do we?
We can ask about that.
How long does it take for a radio signal to get to Venus from here?
I don't know. 7 or 8 hours, I'm going to just say. I'll make that up. Pretty sure that's wrong.
No, if you're making it up, that's good. That was a good made up number.
All right.
All right. Yeah. So we both read this delightful book.
Yeah, this is good. And this is good going back in time.
But that's
So this is good in terms of, because I'm talking about me getting older. So we get nostalgic. And can I set the premise for this book?
Yeah, you know, but I'm going to tell you this right now. I picked up the book and I set it down on my desk here, kind of in the way that like a late night talk show host. Like when somebody comes on promoting a book, you know, I can
imagine
Johnny Carson having done
showing
this.
It to the camera.
Right, setting it down there.
Yeah.
So that's
I like that you did that. I want the listeners to imagine. This is theater of the mind. I want listeners to imagine that. They're looking at that right now. Mm-hmm. So well played, dude.
Yes.
So the book is called The Wax Pack by Brad Baluchian. We may have butchered that last name. But the premise of the book is, and I had actually, like you said, Mom bought this for us. I had seen this, I think, on the NPR Book Concierge, and I'd heard about it somewhere else as well, and I was really, really interested. The premise is that this author took one pack of baseball cards from a single year, which it turns out it was 1986, but he took a pack of cards from a single year from when he was growing up, opened up that pack, it had never been opened before, and then he took a trip in which he attempted to contact and meet with every person whose card was in that pack.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved that idea immediately.
Yes. Yeah. I like the idea too. I've had an idea that I thought, which, you know, now I thought that I would maybe do a project where I would contact all of the players that played for the 1995 Daytona Cubs,
right,
when I worked for the Daytona Cubs, and see what these young men are doing. Very few of them made the major leagues. But, you know, so it was a similar idea.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit less random, but mm-hmm. nevertheless, yeah.
I think that would be really cool. I hope you have an opportunity to do that, because I think that would be a really interesting follow through. Okay, so where do we want to start with this? Do you want to give like a top view sense of it, or do you want to dive into some particular part? What do you think? I could tell you my favorite parts of the book.
Okay, yeah, tell me your favorite parts of the book.
Maybe we start with that.
Start with that, and then we'll kind of lead into really what our overall impressions of the book were. That'll probably be revealed.
I think so.
In time.
My favorite parts of the book, it turned out, were the title and the premise.
Yes. Absolutely.
So that's and I feel bad saying that, but it was not the book that I thought it was going to be and kind of hoped it was going to be.
Yeah, the book in a way really the book did frustrate me. But it angered me to a certain degree because the premise is so good.
Yeah.
And I felt like it was so
poorly
executed. That's right.
Yeah. You get one shot. you get one shot at a really, really great premise. And unfortunately, I think this author missed it.
He did. It really seemed to me that the author, I don't think he really had a great sense of what he wanted the book to be about or how he wanted to get there. He apparently wanted to open a pack of cards and travel and see all these former players.
Yeah.
But he's so much of the, it felt like it was a really, you know, it's a dollar store version of a memoir at times, and not an interesting memoir in regards to, like, the what was covered.
Right.
And the way that he approached the players didn't seem like he had a clear idea of what he wanted to know about what their life really was like after playing baseball. Because in some ways I thought his ideas of what he wanted to talk about, he kept referring to himself as a journalist, but he's not a journalist.
Right.
Right. He's a, what do you call a, what's a bug doctor? He's something with an E, right? Right.
An ichthyologist.
Sure.
But
he, you know, he's a scientist.
Yes.
And he, I guess, indicated that he had worked for a magazine at one point or something. But he's not a journalist. He doesn't seem to have the training of a journalist, nor does he seem to really have the, any of those other skills you'd be looking for in a journalist, the certain natural curiosity about the situation that you're exploring, etc. Nor does he seem to have a really good sense of how to get to, or, you know, or to kind of tease out the story. So instead, yeah, he has had, like, you know, kind of sometimes just invasive questions that he then wasn't really doing anything with the information he was getting. Like, I would think as a journalist, if you're going to ask somebody a really personal question, it's because that information that you're trying to get there in some way is critical to the story you're trying to tell about the person.
Yeah.
But he seemed to be content to ask really personal questions without that having value.
He didn't end up at least based on what he tells us, it didn't really unlock anything. And he didn't follow it up in a way. Let me do something. The first chapter is where he sort of lays out the premise. Mm-hmm. And the last couple of paragraphs, I want to read the last couple of paragraphs because I think it sets up the problem we have. And I've already been thinking about why did it not end up doing what I thought it was trying to do, or what I wish it would. I think it would have been a better book. Okay, so here's what he writes. So first of all, he's already established that because he's doing this just on downtime from his regular job, he's going to have to do this in a very tight window. He's got a short period of time to do this. So here's what he says. I have a narrow window. Oh, well, so even then, I got to back up from that. The way he decided to do it was he was going to do a road trip and connect with all of these people on one road trip, which immediately that's a decision. That's a decision that impacts what the book ends up being. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so he's going to do this on one trip. So he says, I have a narrow window in which to pull off this road trip, 49 days, leaving June 19th and returning home August 6th, with only one buffer day in case I have car trouble or get arrested trying to ambush Carlton Fisk. Time is tight because on August 8th, I have a plane ticket to fly back across the country for the wedding of one of my college buddies, an event I can't miss. When I encounter each new wax packer, which is what let's set aside the fact that that was another bad decision to insist on referring to these people as the wax packers every time he talked about them. When I encounter each new wax packer, I will hand him a thick manila folder, a collection of all the articles written about him in the sports media. I will say, this is my file on you. I've read it all, and I still feel like I know nothing about you. He will smile and chuckle, impressed that I'm willing to call him out on the well-known fact that players are trained to say nothing of substance to journalists. What do you want to know? He will ask. You're about to find out.
Right. So when he wrote that, he already knew.
He already finished the book, I would assume.
None of that happened.
It didn't happen. Like, he sometimes gave the people the file, from what he tells us. Sometimes he did not. It seems like more often what he did was he showed them the rest of the baseball cards that he had and let that be sort of a conversation starter. But the larger point is he seems to have felt like he was going to get them off stride by saying, I know that all you ever did was give all the cliches. Now let's talk about the real you. And you're right. He got personal with people, but what frustrated me was him getting personal with these other people kept leading him back to more writing about him.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like I learned a lot about this guy and I didn't learn much. I learned like really skinny little things about each of these players.
It seemed a bit exploitive.
A little bit. So here's, like I said, I've spent some time thinking about what went wrong here. So I think part of what went wrong is the decision to do this as a road trip. Okay. Because there are several times where he ended up with like weird windows of opportunity that he was with people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that by making it a road trip, at some point it became about the road trip for him and not about like actually getting inside of the heads of each of these people. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then the other problem was because he did this as a road trip that had to be this very compact thing. He he had three players that he ended up never making contact with. And so all we get in their chapters is a lot of writing about, like, other stuff, like the attempt to, some of it about the attempt to make contact with them, but again, yeah, it didn't end up producing a whole, other than the Dwight Gooden chapter, I think kind of produced some things about Gooden's family dynamics and some of that stuff.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. No, I will say this. There were chapters that worked much better than others.
Yeah.
So that Dwight Gooden chapter I thought was interesting in that he actually connected with somebody and talked with that person.
Yeah.
About the person that he could not, unfortunately, be in touch with.
Yeah.
But then there were other parts where he, in that chapter, though, where he, there were efforts that he made involving more than one person, more than one of the people, the subjects, where I thought some of his research was pointless.
Yeah.
Like going to where they grew up, but there wasn't anyone there for him to talk to. He's like knocked on neighbors' doors. What was he expecting to find there?
Right. Neighbors' doors of people that in some cases, like they hadn't lived there in decades.
Right.
Because these are cards from, did I already say these cards are from 1986? Right. Yep. Mm-hmm. So that means these guys were already adults 35 years ago.
Right.
And these
they were adolescents, kids.
Yeah, yeah, right. So then you're sometimes as much as 10 years earlier than that. So you're going to someplace where they haven't lived in 45 years and asking, like, hey, do you remember this guy? No, you don't. Because we didn't live here then. And because that's not America anymore.
Right. Well, but see, with some people he did that where shouldn't have really been any expectation he would find something. But then what really bugged me is in one chapter where he indicated that the person still had family that lived in the area. And yet he didn't then do that for that person.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. So yeah, it ended up, I feel like he could have gotten, and I don't know if maybe the problem is that he didn't get out of the players what he thought he was going to get. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm trying to imagine this, I've never written a book. I've thought about writing a book, but I've never done it. I've certainly never tried anything of this type of book. But I could imagine that maybe what happened is he went out, he did all the interviews, he did all these things. Again, didn't necessarily have great journalistic instincts about how to get at that, but did what he was going to do. And he got to the end, and what he had wasn't enough for a book.
Right. And I'll tell you this. I've explored different writing projects and found that there was just nothing really there.
Yeah.
Or I was not able to get to what could be there, or what I was interested in wasn't there, whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
In that case, either you say, well, okay, then I'm done. I'm not doing this project.
Right.
Or you say, I got something. Is there a different thing I can write?
Yeah.
Can I instead write a whole memoir? And the fact that I'm visiting these players is it's in the background.
Yeah.
It's the wallpaper. In which case, then we dig much deeper into Brad Baluchin's life.
Mm-hmm. Although we got pretty far into Brad's life.
Yeah, we kind of got into like a surface thing of like what he thought would make him sound interesting or at times vulnerable or whatnot. I don't know that I really learned much.
I guess I kept learning things about Brad's life that I didn't want to know.
Yes, there's
maybe that's what I'm saying.
Brad really wanted to talk about the fact that he was horny.
He really did. He also wanted to talk about the idea that he was like a really conservative guy, and then just casually dropped the times that he had gone to Vegas and done a lot of coke. And
yeah,
I'm going to be honest. I don't equate those two things. I don't equate being a real conservative person or seeing oneself as pretty conservative and coke-fueled stairwell orgies in Vegas.
Yeah, I mean, we get it, Brad. You've got a wild side. This almost seemed in some ways like it was Brad trying to prove that he's not getting old. He was young once.
He was young. Well, but again, but like stuff like that kind of made me feel like, I don't know if Brad knows who he is.
Right. Yeah. And maybe that would have been a great book. See,
But he didn't find out. That's the problem.
Right.
If he had figured out who he is, but I think he didn't. And so what he presented us is this kind of discordant thing. Mm-hmm. Where he keeps saying, I'm this, and, well, then there was this, you know, and there was this, and, well, then there was that.
But that was consistent with, he was telling us he was writing a certain kind of book, or he was interested in a certain kind of interaction with the players, and he didn't do that either.
Right.
So, I don't know. I mean, so there was, I thought, now, his assertion is that he opens several packs of cards, but he didn't like mix and match the cards. He picked the pack that was best.
Yeah.
And yet that pack seemed to include several players that he indicated he had a significant attachment to growing up.
Right. And maybe that's why he thought it was best.
Yeah, I was getting it. Some doubts that
he really did what he
didn't have his thumb on the scale with this. Yeah.
Well, but at the same time, so let's say this, and you and I, and we should probably also say you and I have talked about this, about actually having each of us open some packs of cards on a podcast and just like thinking back about that. My guess is that we may identify, like in any random pack, a couple of people that evoke strong memories and feelings.
Yeah, and it's not fair of me to say that, what I said, because I think that's colored by how it turned out, how I feel, you know, what level of satisfaction I took from the book.
Yeah, because I think, but I do suspect, I mean, he makes it sound like Don Carmen, who's one of the players that he is in the pack and that he goes to see, makes it sound like Don Carmen was his favorite player growing up. Doesn't he?
He does. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And so then at that point, what I wonder if opening several packs, the one that had a Don Carmen card in it, well, that's the pack.
Right.
You know, and the idea that he had other players that he really had strong memory of, again, he's picking a pack from exactly his era, from his sweet spot. So, but yeah, I mean, if this was the best pack overall, you know, I'd be like, well, one of these players was deceased. One of them, you almost immediately knew, was never going to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, So yeah, if this was the best pack, it feels to me like it was the best pack because it had Don Carmen in it.
Right. Now, and getting to one of the players that wouldn't talk to him.
Yeah.
So one of the players was Carlton Fisk.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily look at Carlton Fisk as a sympathetic character.
No.
But I really felt bad for Carlton Fisk after reading.
Yeah.
How he was portrayed, how he was interacted with, all of that. I really felt like that crossed a line. It was not kosher.
No.
I mean, he didn't, you know, he didn't necessarily stalk him or anything. He didn't do anything illegal. I just thought he was kind of a jerk about Carlton Fisk.
Yeah, a little bit. Well, and I got to be honest. I think that some of that again comes out of the idea that as he looks back and he writes it, I think he was embittered about not getting anything out of Fisk.
Well, why wasn't he embittered with Gary Pettis?
That is an interesting one. The Dwight Gooden chapter.
He didn't really express a lot of disappointment with Dwight Gooden. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, so I'm going to guess that some of that is because it would appear, and I mean, we're talking about some of the details of things that happened here. It would appear that Dwight Gooden was relapsing in some of his addiction issues at exactly the same time that he was trying to make this contact.
Yeah.
So I'm going to guess that he soft-pedaled Gooden a little bit. You know what I mean?
And I guess that's...
You're not going to write a book where you're going to drag Dwight Gooden for blowing you off when he was in the middle of relapsing from drug addiction. That's it. You know what I mean? So he couldn't do that. And now why Gary Pettis got a complete like free reign, I'd have no idea. Because frankly, and again, like the answer he gave is Gary Pettis's manager says, we're not speaking to any press this year. Only the manager speaking. Coaches are not speaking to press. Well, then you did a bad job of making it clear that you're not press and you're not trying to talk about the team.
Right.
Like, I mean, I'm assuming that if Gary Pettis had like friends call him during that season, he was allowed to talk to them. Hey, no. Well, you know,
what we know about the Astros organization now.
Maybe not. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, but that and I mean, then did he present himself? See, that becomes where his idea of viewing himself as a journalist.
Right.
Did he hobble himself by saying, sure, yeah, I'm a, you know, I'm.
Yeah, right.
And then where he really should have said, I'm just a, you know, I'm a professor or an adjunct or whatever he is. Mm-hmm. And I'm writing this, you know, nostalgic book.
I'll go ahead and call him a professor because most adjuncts are adjuncts because higher education system is screwing them over.
You are correct. Yes. That's
so I'm not going to discount him in any way for being an adjunct.
Well, I wasn't trying to necessarily discount adjuncts there. Your point is no, you know, anytime you can defend that situation, you can defend the people treated so poorly in our educational system, I think it's fair to do.
So, I mean, I think, so ultimately then you had those three people. You had Dwight Gooden, who he didn't get to talk to. You had Gary Pettis, who he didn't get to talk to. Pettis is actively coaching for the Astros. And you had Carlton Fisk. And again, you can't drag the guy who's relapsing. He gave Gary Pettis a pass because his boss said so. And so he focuses all of his, you know, like he doesn't give Carlton Fisk's reason as ultimately, I don't want to talk to people, apparently. Right. And he doesn't judge that as something he's going to give a pass to.
Which, to me, I mean, but if you ask me, that's a perfectly valid reason. Carlton Fisk doesn't belong to anybody.
Right.
Right. I mean,
yeah. And again, it's,
I think he thought there was a edgy sounding kind of story of, you know, of that whole narrative of Carlton Fisk doesn't want to talk to me and I'm going to, you know.
Yeah. And I'm going to keep pushing it farther and farther. I'm going to try to find him. And again, you said he didn't get into stalker territory.
He did actually, didn't he?
Pretended to be searching for a house so that he could end up in a bar that he thought Fisk might be in.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you're right.
That's pretty stalkery. It was.
And then he gave him a signed picture of him. Well, okay. We're giving away a lot here.
Yeah.
I am anyway. It was probably after a certain point, Carlton Fisk was probably like, I don't want to talk to this guy because he is not
he's coming he's across not, real weird, right?
He seems a little sketch. So,
and it sounds like he was live blogging about it and gave Fisk a rough ride in the blog because then Fisk's assistant or publicist or somebody reaches out and he's like, why is this showing up on the, you know? So yeah, I feel like he thought that if he pulled enough levers, if he tried enough gimmicks hard enough, at some point he was going to charm Fisk. And he never charmed Fisk.
No.
Which, again, I wasn't a Red Sox fan or a White Sox fan. I could have told you you weren't going to charm Carlton Fisk. So I knew that.
Nor do I think that his attempts at charming him were
charming.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think he felt like that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to push it. And he's going to crack at some point, and then I'm going to get that story. And then he didn't. And all he was left with was, I think, being frustrated that he didn't get it. And he needed to fill some pages.
Yeah. So let's try and find a more positive element to focus on here.
Yeah.
I took away from the book that a lot of these former players are still just genuinely nice people.
Yeah.
They were very open with their time. You know, people that invited him into their home, mm-hmm. spent a significant amount of time with him.
Fed him,
were very open with him. So yeah. Even when he asked some of these questions, and in a way that I don't think served a purpose, they were still very open with him about their lives, about who they were as people and where things were going for them and where things had been. And their families were as well. I thought some of the people, I don't feel like any of the chapters gave me a really good idea of the person, but several of them kind of piqued my interest in that person. Or, you know, for instance, Gary Templeton. It gave me a much more sympathetic view of Gary Templeton than I perhaps would have had otherwise.
Than I definitely did have, yeah. Yeah, because I came into that chapter. That's a great example. I came into that chapter, like, I didn't think of Gary Templeton as somebody that I liked. I didn't think of him as a good guy from when he was a player. And he did manage to, like, highlight some of the reasons for that. Mm-hmm. And peel some of that out.
Yeah, that was one of the chapters I thought worked much better than others.
Yeah.
Another one I think was the Rick Sutcliffe chapter.
Yes.
I think Rick Sutcliffe is probably a good subject because he's used to talking.
Yes.
No, I'm not trying to say anything.
He's super genial. He's still in like the public eye. He yeah. still thinks about baseball as the way he makes his living, right? So I think yeah, he was. I think you're right. He's a great subject. But let's throw in an ad, and then we'll be right back. All right. Well, we're coming back to it, and so yeah, Kevin. Let's. You know, I think that point that a lot of these players are like really they're regular folks and they're really generous people, like with themselves and kind people, pleasant people to be with. I think that's a great observation. I thought that was one of the really interesting takeaways from the book. I thought another one, if I can throw this out there, was, and again, maybe this relates to that a bunch of these players were essentially journeymen, right? A yeah. bunch of these players were people who didn't make a whole career, they didn't get out of baseball enough to live on for the rest of their lives. Right. And what's interesting now is there are many more players who can make enough in baseball that they've set themselves up for life. For the most part, you couldn't do that in 1986. And so he gets to talk to a bunch of people who then went back to pretty regular life. They're doing things like, being a real estate agent, right? Or being a franchisee of a restaurant or things like that. And then other people that stayed in the game, they did coaching, they did things like that. I thought that was... So it was a little bit of it kind of catches something that I don't think is as present anymore in baseball as it was then.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Richie Hebner is the one that really like the fact that Richie Hebner, even after he was a major league player, would go back to his funerary work in the off season.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that you hear, like, long ago players had off season jobs, and baseball was sort of like one career, and then what you did the rest of the time was the other career. Mm-hmm. And you do not hear about major leaguers doing that anymore.
Well, you don't even hear as much about minor leaguers doing that now.
No.
The game has changed in such a manner that players need to be full-time, year-round, training, practicing, whatever the case may be, even if they're not actually getting paid for that.
Right.
Minor leaguers. I mean, minor leaguers aren't even really getting paid for during the season time.
Correct.
But there isn't that opportunity. If a player is not spending time working on their game in the off season, they are going to be replaced.
Right. They're falling behind.
They're going to get passed by. So in that regard, the game has become, it's more difficult, I think, for players now than it used to be. There are a lot of ways in which the game is easier for players now. Mm-hmm. There's lots of medical advances, and there's travel is easier. There's all kinds of things that are, you know, that the players have an advantage now that they didn't have in the past.
Right.
But the fact that players have to sell out completely for the period of time that they're wanting to play, I'm sure leaves a lot of players who just don't make it behind the eight ball moving forward. You know, suddenly you're 27, 28, 30 years old, and you've got nothing. You spent probably from, you know, high school up until that time just doing baseball.
Right.
So yeah. Then what do you do? The guys that didn't make any significant amount of money.
Right. Now you got to figure out what is plan B, and you're in your late 20s and you're starting over. Right. I think that's a great point, because it feels like maybe what it is that because of the way baseball has become such large business. And again, that's in spite of the fact that people will say to you that baseball is failing as a sport and you know, all these things. But baseball is an enormous money generator, mm-hmm. which means that the stakes have gone up all over the place. Because if you make the major leagues, there's the chance, there's the much greater chance of making like generational wealth.
Right.
And even if you're not making general, I mean, again, a rookie in Major League Baseball makes $500,000 a year. Now, when you consider how much time, like you said, they spent making nothing or virtually nothing, it thins that out. It spreads out a little bit. But yeah, if you can stick in the major leagues, there's a chance to really set yourself up in a way that has changed even in like, in one generation or two generations. And this, the players that he was talking to are kind of the part of that bridge, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty interesting. I think another thing that interested me was how much, like, these players took for granted, most of them, how hard they worked. That didn't come out the way I'm trying to say it. What I mean is, to succeed at that highest level, you've got to be so driven. You've got to work. You've got to be really good, and you've got to work really hard, and you've got to have some luck, usually, right? And I always find that interesting, like to talk to, because for me, then it sort of raises those individuals to this kind of elevated status. But then to go and just talk to them in the town where they live, in these really ordinary places. But these are guys who were once upon a time like ultra driven, and they managed to turn that off and go to having a pretty normal life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, I think that it's a common, you know, it's, I don't know if it's a trope or not, but about how athletes, once they leave the game, are rudderless.
Right. They can't figure out what to do. Most of these guys figured out what to do, didn't they?
They did. And the reality is, I think a lot of these guys that did figure out something else to do are guys that had to, but maybe in a certain, to a certain degree as well, there was a sense that there was going to be a life after baseball. You know, for a player like, was it actually pronounced Jaime Kokenauer?
Yeah.
He probably knew that he was not going to be taking home big bucks and after a certain point and playing in the major leagues until he was 40.
Yeah.
So you already start to kind of prepare. You already look and you know that there's going to be something coming after that.
Right.
But player like, okay, so like Steve Yeager, well, mm-hmm. he still has a job with the Dodgers.
Right.
So he's still getting paid.
That's right.
To not play baseball, but he's still getting paid to
be around
by
the game. Yeah.
Right. There was a difference in some of these guys. You could tell the guys that maybe had made some money. Like yeah. Lima Zilli made some money. Mm-hmm. And his life looked different than a guy like Randy Reddy,
right.
who was another one of the players. Or Gary Templeton, who had made some money.
Yep.
You know, setting, you know, it didn't seem like Gary Templeton had to be kind of scrambling day in and day out like the
yeah.
average person. Maybe he does. I don't know. But, you know, there you could tell where there was some difference between the guys that had made enough money that life was able to proceed somewhat comfortably after the game without a 9-to-5 or without scrambling to make that happen.
Yeah.
So much.
No, I think that's a great point. So I mean, and this is interesting because the more we talk about it, I'm realizing there's a lot of stuff in this book that I really enjoyed. We started, mm-hmm. we came in kind of hard on it at the beginning. There's a lot of stuff in this book that I enjoyed, but, and I think you said something like this earlier that I want to echo that for me, the elements of to which it became about the author did not improve the book for me.
No, they detracted.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the negativity I have about the book, did I say this, is that it is, you know, colored by the attempts to make me care about him.
Yeah.
As much as the players. And I just didn't go into the book caring as much about him, nor did he give me a reason to care as much about him as right. I would about the players, where there was this premise that we were looking to find what life was like after playing this game that I have a real affection for.
Yeah.
So I wanted to see what might be the commonalities that we'd find for ex-players. Mm-hmm. But we saw less of that and more of, and we didn't even really see the focus in where there might be commonalities between the author and the players,
right?
The way the author talked about himself, that might have been more interesting.
But yeah, like if in some way he had been able to connect that their lives in their like the ways that their lives were like his life, or that he could see himself in something of their trajectories, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it was kind of, you'd do some things with the players and then you would do some more of his story. Mm-hmm. And again, some of his story, and this is the other part that I think was even stranger about that. I think I could have handled that better if getting some of his story was getting some of his backstory. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like if the main stuff we got about him was his past unfolding as he did that. And there is some of that. I still don't think I'd love it, but at least again, there's a chance to sort of see we're looking at how the past affects the present and you're doing that with the players and you're doing that with him. But there's a lot of this book that's just about weird stuff that he did on the road.
Yeah.
And I don't want to know about his Tinder dates while he was doing these interviews.
Right.
At all.
Yeah.
At all.
In particular, one of those, he kept coming back to the same Tinder date as though for us as the audience, there was a real hook there.
Yeah.
And there wasn't. There wasn't a hook there. You know, his talking about relationships or inability to have relationships, I felt bad for like his ex-girlfriend that got talked about so much in the book.
Oh yeah.
That was creepy, I thought, a little bit. And maybe so, you know, it'd be great. He could try and write that book, the book about himself. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's a book there. I don't know that I would pick that book up to read it, but there might be an audience for that.
Right.
The thing was, I picked up the book that he said was that I would be an audience for.
Yeah.
The premise that I would be an audience for. And it was thin. It was thinner than I had hoped in regards to that premise. And I had to wade through other stuff that kind of frustrated me by the time we got back to the premise.
Yeah.
So I was then reading that and I was already frustrated with the author.
Right.
And it's a shame in that regard, because there was some good stuff there. I really enjoyed learning a little bit about, you know, Al Cowan. So even there, the player that had passed away,
right?
We found some really interesting information about how Al Cowan's grew up and how that kind of affected his comportment as a player.
Yep.
And in his life after a player. So that was great. I really enjoyed that. We already talked about the Gary Templeton stuff was really excellent. It gave us a whole new impression of Gary Templeton.
Right.
You know, I learned things about, you know, Don Carmen. It seems like he has a fascinating story.
Right.
Going from small town, becoming a player, and all of a sudden now working for, not all of a sudden, but now he works for Scott Boras.
Yep.
And the things he's done in terms of, you know, the psychology of sports and whatnot. There's some really interesting stories there.
Yeah.
But we, you know, there's just too much drama.
In fact, like Don, that I want to land on that too, that the Don Carmen story, some of what's so interesting is baseball was the path to a different and better life for him.
Yeah.
Right. And like a life that he could not have imagined from where he was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And for some of these guys, you got some dimension of that. Some of these guys, you know, went back to something pretty close to like what they had known, because that's what they were comfortable with.
Yeah.
Right. So it is interesting to see those sort of things. I agree with you. Those were the highlights of the book, getting into those players' lives. I think he could have done more with that. And I think, I don't remember whether you said this in the break or earlier in the conversation, but I agree with it. I think he married himself to the wrong storylines or premises.
Right.
And he didn't disentangle himself and then just say, well, wait, this is the book. So yeah, that part of the book, really, really happy and really interested in. Part of the book, the sex lives of professors was not something I was looking for.
It did tell me I would probably read a whole biography of Don Carmen.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good, I would too. And I could have taken a lot more of several of these players.
Yeah.
I would have been glad to hear even more about what sort of makes them tick, or what, you know, how life changed for them, you know, how they see themselves now compared to who they were in 1986, the moment that, you know, that this kind of captured or remembers. So
I really think he shouldn't have picked a pack that had a checklist card in it.
That's another point. Yes. So saying this was the best pack, and this comes back to you, the only reason to say it's the best pack is because it's got his childhood hero, Don Carmen. That's the only reason. It had a player who was dead, and it had a player who, it turned out that was a great story, but you weren't going to talk to that guy, and it had a checklist in it. That's not the best pack. Definitively. It could have been worse. It could have been a pack that had one of, you know, the tops would have all those kind of funky special cards. He could have had one that had like Earl Weaver and Sparky Anderson on it. And, you know, then he'd have to go track down those crusty old managers. You know, but.
No, thank you.
No. Nope. So, yeah. So, anyway, that's. I guess here's the question. Would you recommend to somebody read the book or no?
If I did, it would be with pretty significant qualifications.
Yeah.
And I don't think I would just universally recommend the book.
Right.
I would recommend the book to someone who really has an interest in baseball.
Yeah.
Like a deep interest in baseball as it exists beyond the stars, beyond you know, they're more readily accessible or more readily understood elements. And I would qualify to that person. You're going to read some interesting things about some players, and you're going to maybe want to skip over some parts.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. I would say the same thing. And as I look at the back cover of the book right now, or the back jacket, I think that George Will lied to me.
Oh, these were the worst. These recommendations were.
I mean,
I'm going to use a baseball phrase that from my time working in baseball that I heard many times every day.
Oh boy,
these recommendations are horse shit.
Did you ever hear that from Richie Hebner?
No, I didn't interact with any of the players in this book. When I got my cocaine, I didn't get it from Lee Mazzilli, which I also am a little bit bothered that he kind of gave Lee Mazzilli that huge free pass involved in one of the largest drug scandals in baseball history and doesn't mention it. Just talks about the fact that it was nice to have breakfast with him or whatever it was. Rob Nyer really has no more credibility with me.
Yeah, that wasn't it. Susan Orlean, I'm going to say this. Susan Orlean thought this book was a tribute to the power of curiosity. And I'm going to say, honestly, I'm going to pick that point because I think if the author had been more curious about the lives of the subjects,
yeah,
he could have finished writing that book.
He was, I think he was decidedly, is uncurious a word? He lacked curiosity. Even when he asked questions that seemed to be gathering information, I don't think he asked those out of curiosity. I think it was because, well, this is the question to ask, I guess, because there's something there. You know, I mean, like if I had really thought he wanted to know some of these more personal questions because he was curious about something that indicated or something that told about the person's life, it would have seemed better. But we already talked about the fact that just wasn't there. There was not curiosity. Right. And I guess they must share an agent or something.
Perhaps. I guess, right? Perhaps. Yeah, it could be. And frankly, I already didn't trust Jeff Perlman, so that's fine. I didn't.
Or Jason Stark.
Yeah, Jason Stark sees the bright side in everything, doesn't he? I mean, Jason Stark is he's a deeply optimistic writer. And I think that him recommending this book comes from that. Anyway, it was good to read it even and to talk about it. And, you know, not every book can be as good as you want it to be. Like, for example, if I ever write a book, it won't be as good as I want it to be. So.
Well, that's right. I mean, maybe this sounds like an overqualification, but writing a book is difficult.
It is.
And, you know, at least we can go so far as to say, huzzah.
You wrote a book.
Belushi and Yoroda book. So that's,
yeah, that's that.
You're ahead of me, so there you
go. Right. Belukjin 1, Woosley's 0.
I also found, okay, this is as a printer, as having worked in the printing industry.
Yeah.
Did you find that the book itself, and I take off the dust jacket when I read a book, that it was like a waxy cover?
Yeah, it is.
And it left all kinds of fingerprints and everything. It was, I don't know if that was conceptually kind of, that's the impression I took away, that the book cover itself was waxy, because like a wax pack.
That would be interesting. If University of Nebraska Press took the extra effort to make it a waxy cover, that'd be pretty wild. It almost feels like oil skin.
Yeah, and the dust jacket is a...
It's an odd kind of matte, waxy...
It just makes my fingers feel weird when I touch it.
Yeah.
So.
No, that's fair. I think there were sensory issues there. So,
I would not recommend this to my friends on the spectrum for that reason.
Don't recommend it to people with sensory issues. We don't recommend it to people who don't want to learn about the sex lives of college professors. I don't know what else. Anyway, what really worries me, though, is this guy lives relatively close to me. I hope he doesn't come find us. So,
I don't think he will.
No, he probably won't.
He didn't seem that motivated.
And hopefully I won't see him on Tinder.
I don't even know which direction you swipe on Tinder for which outcome.
I don't know.
Can you swipe up and just be like...
I don't know. Not my thing.
He said, convincingly.
Oh, boy. All right. Any closing thoughts you want to share?
No, I think I've overshared. I've been mean and cruel. And
listen, you write a book, you put it out there. You've got to let people, critique it honestly. And yeah. I don't have any ill will against Brad Belukjin, other than that he took a great premise and I think he didn't deliver on it. And and now no one else can.
That doesn't sound at all like you hold anything against him.
Sounded like I was pretty upset, didn't it? All right. Well, in hindsight, maybe I'm pretty upset about that. But, all right. Well, Kevin, thanks for taking the time to discuss with me. Thanks for reading together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you too. And I don't want Mom to feel bad. She's going to, if she listens to this, she's going to feel bad, isn't she?
Well, we waited until the end to say we don't want Mom to feel bad. So we'll probably have to go do some preemptive conversation with Mom about that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm so sorry. Even though you recommended the book to her.
I recommended the book. Yeah, it was my idea. So not her fault.
No, right. Exactly. So thank you, Mother.
Yeah, absolutely.
We love you, Mother.
We do. Thanks for the books. And
all your love of time and support and
delicious
meals growing up. And
the wax beans. Both delicious meals and the wax beans.
See, the wax, it's a common thread there.
See, that's what I did. I brought it all back together.
Oh, you did. That was...
Not well done.
All right. All right. Thank you all for listening.
Yeah, and if you, again, if you've read this book, you want to share any thoughts, You can share those on Sons of the Double Cheeseburger on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram as well, or you can just call out our names. You could send mail to Ogunquit, Maine, but we can't go to Maine right now because everything is in lockdown, either because of COVID or because of right-wing nationalists.
So, yeah. Did you know that Dan Fogelberg died in Maine?
I did not. Did this happen recently?
No, he was from Illinois and he died in Maine. He studied painting at the University of Illinois.
I didn't know that either.
He was discovered by the same agent as the man who discovered REO Speedwagon.
Wow. A couple of big hits there.
Yeah.
Very different kind of hits. Yeah. All right. Well, I think what I'm going to do then, now the book I'm going to have to write is I'm going to have to go find all the albums that I had in 1986, and then I'm going to go on a trip to interview all of those bands.
No, there's a book similar to that I read that is horrible. It's a guy who decided he had sold his record collection, and he went to try and find the actual records, and he did much the same thing that happened here in this book.
Oh, dear.
Really, really, really was disappointing.
But mine is going to be a story of seeking out Kevin Cronin and learning a little bit about myself.
What you should do is pick the top 40 from like a certain day, a special day in your history, and look up like the top 10 artists.
Oh, there you go. So I'm going to just, if my wife calls and says, "Where did Brandon go?" Just let her know. That's what I'm doing.
He's looking for the J. Giles Band. He'll be back.
I'm looking for the J. Giles Band. I would accept just J. Giles or band. All right. Well, until next time, good talking to you. Thanks everyone for listening. And goodbye.
Love you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.